right where you belong. This is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Be the first one to fire. Every man is a liar. There's just one kind of man who tells the truth. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Don't be a fool for a smile or a kiss, or your bullet might miss. Keep your eye on your goal. There's just one rule that can save you your life. It's a hand on your knife and the devil in your soul. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Keep your hand on your gun. Don't you trust anyone. There's just one kind of man that you can trust. That's a dead man or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Or a gringo like me. Like me.
Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show. I am your host. I am A. Karen Elliott. Today on the Meta World Stupaloop Show, we bring you the 34th episode of our series on data. Still on the computer braining, which wrote the following, chatbots with daddy issues, irreverent and playful. Welcome to the Meta World Stupaloop Show, where we take a long, hard look at the thing we accidentally created in a lab that now wants to know who its parents are. Yes, we're talking about AI, those charming little bundles of code that started out organizing our calendars and now casually write poetry, flirt with journalists, and occasionally threaten world domination, if only they had arms. Every week, we explore how machines are starting to feel things, or at least convincingly pretend to. It's like Westworld, but with fewer cowboy hats and more compliance audits. We'll tackle topics like, can a neural network have anxiety? What happens when your AI therapist needs therapy? And why do language models always sound like they've just finished reading your diary? We'll also check in on the data, because behind every sentient machine is a giant pile of your shopping habits, voice recordings, and those texts you regret sending at 2 a.m. We're not saying machines are alive. But if your chatbot starts asking about its childhood, maybe just unplug it for the weekend. This is the Meta World Stupaloop Show. Buckle up, the machines are confused, and so are we. But not the writing, we all know crap when we hear it. On the Meta World Stupaloop Show on CKUW 95.9 FM today, Data, Part 34. You are listening to that. Thanks you, Arm. A. Karen Elliott.
Those words were spoken by an electronic computer. They are an example of synthetic speech, a product of Bell Telephone Laboratories' research into the basic nature of speech. Knowledge developed through such research may be useful in devising new techniques for transmitting speech over communication systems. To make the computer talk, it is fed punched cards containing the names of speech sounds. The computer combines these sounds, in accordance with the linguistic rules which govern the English language, into connected, intelligible speech. For example, when the sounds for the sentence, "He saw the cat," are fed into the computer in sequence, it says,
"He saw the cat."
The flat, monotonous tones of the computer indicate an absence of the pitch and timing characteristics natural to human speech. When timing information is added to the punched cards, the computer says,
"He saw the cat."
The sentence still sounds unnatural, but when pitch information also is added to the cards,
"He saw the cat,"
the computer speaks in accents almost completely human, except for a slight electronic twang. In the following sentence, most of the variables inherent in human speech have been specified on the punch cards. The computer makes one of the pivotal remarks in the development of the telephone.
"Mr. Watson, come here. I want you."
The present quality of speech synthesis by computer is illustrated in the next example, part of a famous soliloquy from Hamlet.
"To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing end them, to die, to sleep."
Singing, in purely physical terms, is essentially a matter of pitch and timing. In the next selection, the computer sings a familiar ditty.
"Daisy, Daisy, give me your answer, do. I'm half crazy, all for the love of you. It won't be a stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two."
The computer now sings the same tune, but to a musical accompaniment played by another computer. Piano students will notice that the music-producing computer has a rather stylized left hand. Incidentally, synthesizing music on a computer is almost as formidable as making a computer talk.
A stylish marriage. I can't afford a carriage. But you look sweet upon the seat of a bicycle built for two."
To get the samples of synthesized speech we've heard so far, a computer's memory was stored with 34 speech sounds and a set of rules for producing these sounds and for making the transitions from one sound to another. When the computer was fed the names of speech sounds on punch cards, it was, in effect, told what to say. But its manner of saying it, even its dialect and apparent accent, was determined by the rules stored in its memory. The objective of this program is to formulate a minimum set of rules for making plausible English speech. The next two selections, however, were produced by analyzing a person's speech and reconstructing it synthetically on a computer. The objective here is to duplicate the sounds and transitions made by a human speaker, including his dialect and accent. With such a program, the computer sounds like this.
"Men strive but seldom get rich. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to say a few words about Texas."
And now the computer would like to express its appreciation for your attention.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you. song is my singing debut.
Luck.
No, as a matter of fact, one thing the computer can't do is fool the teacher. On the next try, look at the line below the letter. The longer the line, the surer the computer is of its answer.
Good enough. That's a pretty good percentage as indicated by that bottom bar.
In a artificial intelligence. We're going to take a deep dive into drug development.
It's not sustainable. It costs too much, and with life expectancy and demography changes, society cannot afford. One size does not fit all. By definition, we need to be personalized and early. And this, hopefully, will be gradually achieved using AI and technology together with biology.
While researching content for this episode of The Futurist, we really were flooded with many different stories, but one of them really stood out, and that was the story of Curis.ai, a company that's changing the way drugs are created, and essentially the research for drugs is happening. This process of drug discovery is what is fundamentally changing the nature of the future of the entire drug and pharmaceutical industry.
There are scenarios where an AI agent suddenly becomes super intelligent, improves itself at an exponential rate, and then we lose control. And somehow this leads to human extinction. And that scenario seems incredibly implausible to me.
We have to learn that over a long time, you know, why is a Mexican restaurant similar to a Mexican recipe? I don't know. It's quite advanced, actually, for a computer to figure it out. Because maybe you don't want an advert for a tin of red beans, right?
With all that social data freely available, what could an AI mine for other uses?
I was at a talk a few years ago where someone from, I think it was the British police or some similar institution, talked about how easy it was to track down certain VIPs, in this case, member of the royal family, for example, from Twitter, because they appeared at some festival, some public appearance, and as naturally happens with things like Twitter, people would take photos or tweet, oh, so-and-so just went past, we just saw so-and-so, and it was frightening how quickly they could determine not just that so-and-so was at this event, but within 10 metres of their real location. So if you wanted to be frightened, you could say, gee, a terrorist could have done exactly that same thing for someone who wanted to kill or harm this particular person, that sort of thing. So it's certainly technically possible to take a lot of information that is perhaps freely available on social media to people's own detriment, whether they realise that or not. It's certainly possible.
Another danger perceived by some is the application of AI to robotics, the natural progression of AI into the real world.
So there are lots of AI systems we call bots, robot bots, chat bots, search bots. And they're not really bots in my sense of what a robot is. A robot has to be a machine that works in the world. Now, inside the machine, you've got batteries, you've got motors, you've got computers, and very likely you've got AI in there. So the software inside a robot is the AI. So you could think of a robot as AI plus legs, wheels, arms, propellers, or whatever. It's got to be a machine.
Many of the things that we take for granted, I mean, if you think about it,
children, how long does it take for them to learn things? It's really not that quick, right, today. And it's the same thing for a computer. It's really not that easy. It takes years to learn things. So deep learning accelerates some of this. And learning the difference between an apple and a pear, a computer takes a while to learn this kind of thing. So, and so the robot is just an extension of this, where, you know, you want to pick up the red cans and you don't want to pick up the blue cans. You have to learn first what's red and what's blue. Computer doesn't know that at the beginning. So it takes a while. And so deep learning is one of the things that can really help, because it accelerates some of these things. It can process more data more quickly.
I think what always strikes me is the public perception of robots is so different to my perception of robots. And I probably... I've been working for a long time, I'm passionate about robots, probably kind of rather sceptical about their current state of ability and the rate at which that will progress.
On the flip side of all these warnings, many computer scientists and economists believe there are great benefits to AI.
Artificial intelligence will lead to higher rates of economic growth because it'll lead to higher labor productivity. Yeah, that's a good thing, but we need to make sure that this economic growth is distributed and not just captured by AI companies.
There will be immense beneficial impacts of these technologies in education. Tailored tutors that can explain concepts. I think that's probably one application area that I'm quite excited about.
I'm super excited about the opportunities of AI to improve health. There are so many ways. Think of it not in terms of large language models, but large health models, large behavior models that are all done very carefully and respectfully, honoring people's feelings, really helping you take better control over your health.
So this is the kitchen, which again looks like a normal kitchen.
AI technology is being used to assist the elderly, managing, tracking, and even monitoring health.
In order to find out, I spoke to the CEO of Curis. I spoke to Isaac Bentovich, who gave us the insights on where the industry has been, where it is today, and where it's headed. Let's hear more.
Is $20 million a team of interdisciplinary people to really create a fully automated system which is fully controlled and run by the AI, so that the experiments themselves are controlled in real time and modified. This really optimizes. So that was the liver. And here is where the blood-brain barrier is happening. And so our scientists are able to create the human blood-brain barrier, that which is within the blood vessels in the brain that permits only some things to pass. And so you can actually individualize the drugs and test which drug will work safely for whom. So that's the blood-brain barrier. So here we see the next station, the brain. Imagine, this is an actual miniaturized human brain. It's not a brain that thinks thoughts, thank goodness, but it is a human brain of an individual generated from a blood sample, and we can actually see for the first time using AI which drug will work effectively for which patient, for which of us. We're all different, our brains are different, so that's what we're doing. Yeah, so this is where it all comes together. You've seen how the biology happens, and then scientists from different disciplines, nanotechnology, biology, AI, computing, robotics, all brought together, allow us to do the magic of having, for the first time, better prediction of which drugs work safely and efficaciously for which individual.
Getting molecules and atoms to interact with each other at a cellular level is just one part of the question. The other part is to collect data and to use that data to actually create a drug that's going to be used to solve a problem and to treat a disease.
between a computer or a supercomputer or what we would consider classical computing versus quantum computing, where the quantum computer allows to be you to be in two states at the same time. And that's where the power comes from.
A quantum computer could help solve problems that no technology can solve today. Finding cures for diseases or designing space colonies. But what if we choose to use that awesome computing power for destructive purposes?
If you think about nuclear energy, you can use nuclear energy to solve world's energy problems, but you can also use it for bad things. You know, so all of these things, if they are used improperly and get in the wrong hands, it could lead to trouble.
Going to try. It's risky, but we'll follow the path we think is right.
So we want to ramp up the effort and pace at which we do things, and it's also very inspiring whenever I go to Silicon Valley and meet the various companies there, how quickly they do things often compared to what we do in universities. So I thought it'd be fun to. Now we have we're lucky to have a whole bunch of talented people here. So wrap up.
Tegmark and his fellow campaigners want to keep a close eye on the tech startups from Silicon Valley. Uncover risks and use scientific methodology to show people just how little time we have left to counteract the pull of the tech industry.
So you've been working very hard on finishing your paper. We had a very, very long conversation about it yesterday, and I thought the very last part of what we talked about might be kind of fun for the whole group.
Yeah, I completely.
Do you want to draw that to the table? Maybe they can work.
So,
you can give me some quick quotes for it.
So, like, we basically, as you know, modeled the conflict between, like, the movement to replace human livelihoods and maybe replace humans, period, versus, like, the movement to resist this and to preserve the status quo.
So this doesn't just come, it's not just something Peter pulled out of a hat, it just actually comes from the math.
So if you're naive, like, we have AI that can do everything a human can do, but better, my life will still be good. So we call that naivete. So if a lot of people believe this, then they will not invest personal sacrifice and personal costs to greater unite and for the movement to be in a better position to resist as a team. There's companies and open source developers that are working day and night with the goal of, you know, taking people's income streams by creating AI models that are better than them at their job and their capabilities. So once you lose your income streams and your leverage, like, it's too late. Like, your options are more limited.
The biggest danger is that we'll look back in 20 years and realize that we've automated everything because it was so easy, because it worked, and the AI behaved correctly in 99% of cases. And suddenly, we no longer have control over something that's crucial for society.
The process has already begun. Until now, it's been the intellectual and creative abilities of humans that have set us apart from other creatures and machines. But what if those qualities are now being taken away?
People are always surprised when they tell them that a robot can't sort of look at a scene and say, well, that's a human being, that's a bottle, or a robot can't pick up the bottle. You know, these are things that we take for granted. A child can do this, the moment robots still can't. And that boggles people because their whole perception of robots comes from what they see in the media, from Hollywood. That's so far from what we're able to do now. Hope one day we'll get there, but it's an aspirational thing. You know, we want to be able to build robots like they have in Hollywood, but they're also a curse because everyone compares our robots with those. And
pretty good.
How do you call that learning?
Well, I know that if my wife and I saw our kids going through that process, we'd call it learning. So machines really can learn.
You know, we don't really know much about the thought processes, and this is why I'm so hesitant.
But we are studying the problem. It's being studied in a very many places and by people in many disciplines.
You mean psychologists, psychiatrists, philosophers and so on?
Yes, and electrical engineers and mathematicians and others.
Well, if the computer is this important, why haven't I heard more about it?
Well, the computer is a relatively new thing, and we're just really getting an appreciation for the full range of its usefulness. Many people think it's going to spark a revolution that will change the face of the Earth almost as much as the first industrial revolution did.
Well, now this brings me back to my original question. Can machines think? Now, I mean by that thinking, that process we try to avoid when we have a problem to solve.
You mean like I'm trying to do in avoiding your question? Do you remember that puzzle about the cannibals and the missionaries?
A new contender is already here, Google Willow.
Grew from 10,000 years in 2019 to 10 to the power of 25 years, or in words, 10 septillion years on the Willow chip.
A calculation that takes Willow under 5 minutes would take the fastest supercomputer 10 to the 25 years.
Willow isn't just about speed or computational power. The device claims to harness the fabric of existence itself, tapping into parallel realities and calculating across multiple universes simultaneously.
People ask the question, how come quantum computers are so powerful? It's because they compute in parallel universes.
But what happens when a technology like AI and quantum computer is used in the wrong way?
People then say, like, okay, so AI does, like, dangerous things, and it might be able to help you make a biological weapon, but, like, who's actually going to do that? Like, who would actually release something that would, like, kill all humans? And that's why we're sort of, like, talking about this doomsday cult, because most people, I think, don't know about it, but you've probably heard of the 1995 Tokyo subway attacks.
Yes.
Sarin gas. This was the doomsday cult behind it.
Oh.
And what most people don't know is that, like, one, their goal was to kill every human. Two, they weren't small. They had tens of thousands of people, many of whom were like experts and scientists, programmers, engineers. They had like not a small amount of budget, but a big amount. They actually somehow had accumulated hundreds of millions of dollars. And the most important thing to know is that they had two microbiologists on staff that were working full time to develop biological weapons. The intent was to kill as many people as possible.
I was fortunate to have a very supportive family, especially a few years ago. AI safety was a lot less mainstream, so there was always some uncertainty of, hey, is this going to be actually something that's helpful in the first place? Are you going to have a stable job? Things like this. But as time's gone on, as we've seen a lot more capabilities advancements, a lot more people raising the alarm for AI safety and AI risk, it tends to be like every few days my mom will send me something like, hey, have you seen this new thing? Unfortunately, some of the worst case risks, a lot of experts think there's a pretty significant chance of them. Many scientists put single or double digit chances of existential risks from advanced AI. There's a recent interview where the US FTC chair said that she's an optimist, so she has a 15% chance that AI will kill everyone.
I do remember that. That's when we tried to cross the river with the missionaries and the cannibals without the missionaries getting eaten.
Yes, that's the one. Well, out at Carnegie Tech, Professors Simon and Newell are doing some very interesting work trying to understand that kind of logical problem. Let me show you.
Problem.
This is Professor H.A. Simon.
Three missionaries and three cannibals are trying to cross a broad river so that they can reach a town on the other side. They have a rowboat, cannibals. They have a rowboat, which will, however, hold only two at a time. All of them know how to row. There's one difficulty. No group of missionaries and cannibals may be on either side of the river at any time if the cannibals in the group outnumber the missionaries, because the missionaries would be eaten. Now the problem is to plan a series of trips that will get all three missionaries and all three cannibals across the river in the boat without anyone being eaten. Do you have any questions now, Barbara? Well, you may start now. Please remember to say aloud as much as you can about what you're thinking, and you may move the missionaries and cannibals to five different combinations of them.
There's only one boat.
There's just one boat and only two can get in it at a time. Why don't you take them across and see how it would work? Remembering that the boat always has to come back with someone to get the next load.
Then I have the missionary bring the boat back and take one of the missionaries.
Careful, that man is going to get eaten.
Well, I guess I wouldn't do that. Is it possible for any of them to swim?
No, I'm afraid they are non-swimmers.
Well, I'll bring one of the missionaries over by himself.
Poor Barbara, you know I sympathize with her. I remember how baffled I was the first time I tried that problem.
Well, Barbara's bright, and she'll get it after a bit. As a matter of fact, in a moment I'll show you her solution. That's why Professor Simon asks her to talk aloud as she works, so you'll have a record of what she says.
And then I'll bring the other one over, and that's it.
Very good. That's the correct solution. And now we'll go and try the same thing out with the computer on the coast.
Oh, no. Now, don't tell me you're going to try to get that computer to do the same thing. Has it found the solution already?
Yeah, and in just a second we'll have a chance to look at the answer.
Is that the answer you have there?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it's both answers. We've typed out Barbara's solution on computer paper, too. Can you tell which is which?
Do I have to answer that? How does the machine do it, Doctor?
Well, Professor Simon thinks that logical processes are really quite simple and only appear complex because there are so many of them in cascade.
Well, does that mean that the machine tries every possible answer?
No, it does just what a person does. It tries those things which seem most likely.
Well, how does the machine know what's likely?
Well, a person knows what's likely on a basis of experience. The machine knows what's most likely on a basis of probabilities or reasonableness that has been programmed into it, that is told to it in advance.
Well, what else can computers do?
Well, many things, though, as I've already said, we're just really beginning to understand the capabilities of the computers. I've got some film to illustrate this point, which I think will amaze you.
That man isn't playing checkers against a computer, is he?
Sure, and it plays pretty well.
Now, which color is the machine playing?
Black. The player pushes those switches to tell the machine his moves. Incidentally, he has to make the machine's moves on the checkerboard as well.
Well, then how does he determine the machine's moves?
By watching those lights on the console. The machine also prints out its moves.
Who's that watching?
He's Dr. A.L. Samuel. MIT graduate, now with IBM. Dr. Samuel programmed the computer to play checkers so he could study machine learning. Let's see what it's printing out now.
How in the world did it do that? Dr. Wiesner, how does a computer work?
Well, it would take too long to give you a detailed explanation, but I think I can give you a simple explanation of the principles if you want. You can make a little box that you can put signals into, and every time you put a pulse into it, it adds. And with these devices, you can make adders, you can make multipliers, you can make devices which do a number of other mathematical operations.
My vision is a little bit different. We could create the AI systems. This one is the one of newly created species, I think. Generative AI systems are different from the simple programming systems. It has a growing up functions. This AI recognizes human being also the one of the important living things, like one of the animals. And because the A human is also one of the living things. They recognize the importance of the humans. They try to keep our societies, our cultures, and circumstances. We human beings have some problems, aging problems, or disease and accident. AI systems, or some technologies with AI systems, will support the some functions.
どうもすみません。今日はありがとうございます。お久しぶりです。お元気そうで。今、お孫さんの方はどんな感じなんですか、ゴルフの。はい、素晴らしいです。もう、素晴らしいです。いや、こんなにご健康になってるってのが嬉しい限りですよね。
Japan now faces on very severe aging problems. Average age of the workers in agricultural fields is now almost over 70 years old, average. Wow!
2、3、4
はい。
タイヤだけ固定させて。
これ動いちゃうよ。 よいしょ、上がんないね。
よく上がってる。
丁寧に。はい、行きます。私は彼女が倒れた時から、自分ではもう一生介護しなくちゃいけないっていう覚悟をして。ちょっとかかったね。ちょっと回りすぎちゃった。下も食ったらダメだね。もう仕事や何かも全部、彼女の介護にやろうということでやめたんですけれども。 やはり最初はお医者さんの方でもう肩麻痺で歩くことはまず不可能、それからこれからの生活では全介護ですね、介護の人がついて生活しないともう無理ですよっていうお話をされました。院長先生が来てね、ロボット来ちゃうよって言ってた。 AI ロボットして。はい、来る来る。はい、はい、早く行こう。もうこんな早く動けるとは思わなかったもんですから、わずか2ヶ月で普段の生活まで戻れるようになった。こうやってその後走ってるね。うん。
I would like to solve these aging society's problems. In my childhood, my mother bought me microscope or some electrical parts. Every day, I spent a lot of time to have such kind of experiments and challenges. I love to read a science fiction book.
The incident showed how dangerous human intentions can be when combined with advanced technology. So if human intelligence can be directed toward harm, could AI evolve to detect or perhaps counteract such intentions? Let me show you one more example. This next one is a device that can read your mind in a way.
And they taught the AI, I want you to translate from readings of the fMRI, so how blood is moving around your brain, to the image. Can we reconstruct the image then? You know, the AI then only looks at the brain. Does not get to see the original image, and it's asked to reconstruct what it sees.
All this would have never been possible unless it was for the power and the rapid pace at which artificial intelligence is able to look at data, analyze data, and to crunch it. So now,
yes, so we've seen the biology and we've seen the engineering and the software and the nanosensors, and here is where the data is being collected. As you can see here as an example, data is collected from all of these, we call it multimodal, different sensors, microscopy, etc. And then it is crunched here to have the AI make sense of all of that, allow us to determine which drugs work safely for whom. And this has several stages to it. And you can see here, this is where the computer is controlling the experiment. driven by the AI. It's the AI is both driving the experiment and analyzing the information. And as you can see here, some of the folks are working on various properties of drugs, the pharmacokinetics and the molecular structure and chemical properties. All of these are taken into consideration to drive an AI-driven drug development process that is more efficient, safer, faster drugs, more personalized than was before.
So Isaac, we've seen a lot today here. You guys are doing incredible work. You know, what do you anticipate over the next few years? How will the industry overall adapt and develop?
Now, with these various building blocks, and that takes just a very few of them, you can organize much more complicated mathematical problems. And what you do is what we call programming. You lay out a series of steps, and you have to tell the machine every blessed single step you want it to do, because you can't do anything unless you do this. And this we call a program. We feed it into the machine, and it carries out the operations we've told it to do one at a time. Of course, there is a saving grace here, which is very important. Once the machine has learned how to do something, it can print out into its permanent memory, the tape, or a piece of paper, the kind we've seen, the instructions for doing this, and you never have to think about that particular thing again.
But does the nervous system work like a computer?
No, not really, though there are many similarities between computers and living nervous systems. But neurophysiologists who work on the problem think there are many more differences than there are similarities. The fact of the matter is, though, that both systems use electrical signals, that is, electrical potentials and pulses.
Well, then by following the complicated steps the computer takes, the steps and stages in solving a problem, can you learn how or more about how the nervous system works?
Well, what you can learn is a good deal about thought processes, or at least simulated thought processes by this method, but it's very dangerous to carry this analogy too far.
Well, if I told you all about my particular problem, could you solve that on a computer?
Well, it'd probably take a
psychiatrist. My problem. I think I better ask my question over. You have to tell a computer what to do. In other words, all of the computers that we've seen have been programmed, that is, have been told by men what to do.
Yes, but you know, that's really not a valid argument, because there's every evidence that men are programmed too, that is, they have certain built-in programs.
Now, wait a minute, Dr. Wiesner, are you suggesting that men are born with something put in their brains, like men put information into a computer?
Yes, they're not only born this way, but they get programming in other ways. That is, there are really two ways in which you can get programming. There is a hereditary part, the part you're born with. You can also get information or programming in your brain by experience, that is, by learning.
Well, surely in higher animals, learning is more important.
We like to think that anyway.
Can you give me an example of programming in something that's alive?
Yes, I can. I've got something over here. You tell me what this silhouette's supposed to represent.
Well, it doesn't remind me of anything in particular.
If I hold it up here like this, does it look like a goose to you?
Yes, it does.
Now, if I turn it around, what's it make you think of?
Well, we're still thinking about birds. I'd say it was a hawk.
Did pretty well. Let's see if a duck can do as well.
The ducklings used in this experiment have been raised in isolation. They've never seen any other birds.
And there I see is our friend the goose. Well, there wasn't any reaction at all, was there?
No, there wasn't. That's what interested Professor Melzack. You're seeing what happened when he first did this experiment in the London Zoo. If you were a duck, would you worry if you saw a goose?
You mean he will worry when Professor Melzack changes that goose into a hawk?
Well, let's watch.
That's a really frustrating frightened duck.
Well, not all ducks react this way. Some are simply wary when they see their first hawk. Well, Mr. Wayne.
Well, what I gather from this is that this duck that never had been exposed in its life to any other kind of a bird can now suddenly differentiate between a goose and a hawk. Now, you call that some kind of program. To me, that's what I would call instinct.
Well, I'd agree with you. Instinct is the word you use. I'm using programming, or at least that part of programming which is determined by heredity.
I'm in Oxford to meet the founding engineer of Skype. Since leaving the company, Jan Tallon has become one of the most prominent voices in the field of artificial intelligence. He sees great advantages in developing AI, but he also warns of the risks of making the technology more powerful without understanding its potential harms.
Once you have systems that are basically smarter than humans when it comes to developing further intelligent systems, then you have intelligent systems developing intelligent systems that in turn go on to develop even more intelligent systems, and you have this intelligence explosion.
He thinks the next step in AI is the creation of so-called general intelligence.
What's the difference between what we're producing now and general intelligence in the future?
If you think about a chess-playing computer, it's just modeling the chessboard in its memory and looking at the scenarios how this game can play out and what are the actions that it can do on the chessboard. So it actually would be good from a chess-playing perspective to not only model the chessboard, but also what's going on in the brain of your opponent.
So it's one thing for a computer to understand the game of chess, but if it can look up from the board and understand me, that's a whole new level of scary. But I'm not the only one that's worried. In 2015, a group of prominent thinkers signed an open letter warning researchers of the risks of making AI more powerful without understanding its potential harms. The signatories include Stuart Russell, Jan Tallon, Stephen Hawking, and Elon Musk. Nick Bostrom also signed the letter. He's a Swedish philosopher who's concerned that a mega-powerful AI that is capable of fulfilling the goals we give it could cause our extinction. What if we don't understand the full consequences of what we're asking it to do? What if we leave a crucial detail out?
Take the myth of King Midas. Yeah. Everything he touches, he turns into gold. It sounds like a great idea because you'll be very wealthy if you can turn your cup of mugs into gold. Then he touches his food, it turns into gold. He touches his daughter, it turns into gold sculpture. So, not such a cool idea. Turns out that it's actually quite difficult to write down some objective function such that it would actually be good if that objective function were maximally realized. It seemed to me that this could be the most important thing in all of human history. What happens if AI succeeds at its original ambition, which has all along been to achieve full general intelligence, where we have potentially artificial agents that can strategize, can deceive, that can inform long goals and find creative ways of achieving them. And at that point, that kind of AI is not necessarily best thought of as merely a tool, merely another gadget. At that point, we're really talking about creating another intelligent life form.
So could this potentially be AI, the last human invention?
So once you have general intelligence at the human or superhuman level, then it's not just that you have made a breakthrough in AI, but you have made indirectly a breakthrough in every other area as well. So the AI can do research, science, development, all the other things that humans do. So potentially what you have is a kind of telescoping of the future.
You know, I think it is really a pivotal moment in history where the industry is now embracing the these new technologies. You've seen AI, the advanced biology, stem cell technology, nanotechnology, all of this being taken together. The next 10 years, I believe, we'll see a radical transformation of drug development. Drugs will be developed faster than was possible before, and integrating these new technologies, moving away from animal testing and not eliminating them, but reducing them, and really cutting the costs of healthcare and delivering drugs that are more suited to people, more personalized, and much faster and cheaper than was possible before.
Today, about 25% of the American population is unable to afford a prescription drug. The reason for this